Okay, now I belong standing. It's time for our kids' corner. Kids, if you can come front. And it's come to my attention that I have failed to honor our acolyte appropriately here, so we should give Janet a quick round of applause. So, now, I wanted to talk with you guys today about maps, and then it dawned on me that you might not have ever seen one of these in the day of electronics. Have you ever seen one of these? Kind of like, it kind of folds out, and it's got all like the different roads and stuff. Okay, so you are familiar with that, right? So, but you know what the cool thing about maps is? Once you can read a map, you can kind of predict what's coming next, right? Kind of makes sense, right? So, like, I see on my map that, you know, there's going to be a town called Reading coming up, and, you know, pretty soon there it is, right? So, that is, if your map works right, that's how it should go. But I have a story about this. See, a number of years ago, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't tell it like this, because I took this group of kids out in the forest, right? And we were up on the Appalachian Trail. You know what that is, right? Okay. So we went up there, and I had a map section of the trail with me that somehow along the years of use had a little sticky spot had developed in, and, well, two of the pages of the map stuck together. And but wildly enough, even though the two pages were stuck together, everything still aligned to the next section. Well, so, you know, here's the benefit of the map, right? I knew that I should get to start to see some of the things on the, you know, the big bear that looks like the rock, or the big rock that looks like the bear, right, that one. So knew that I should be seeing these things, but yet they never seemed to come. And it was getting darker, and I thought, well, we must have gone 10 miles by now. And that's when it dawned on me that, hey, there's this other little flap in the back of the map here. So I pulled it a little harder, and two more sections came up, and we had six extra miles in there. So maps are handy if you know how to read them, right? And if you've got them oriented the right direction. So I want to talk about kind of a map that the Bible gives us today with the bigger people. Sound like a kind of fun expedition here? By the way, do you want to hike with me sometime? I promise I learned my lesson. Oh, okay. All right, guys. Thanks for playing along this morning. I appreciate you so much. So, but may the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be pleasing in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. It's actually so helpful to know exactly where you stand, isn't it? And the Bible describes a situation in which we are at war, yet we seem to be fighting this war alongside so many people that never really know the enemy, never engage, and don't know what's going on. This is the cosmic battle which has been raging since the beginning of human history. Now, Revelation 12 might seem like a bit of an odd choice as a Christmas message, but bear with me on this one, please, because I want to do this twice in a row, actually, from two different perspectives. The first one today is actually heaven's view of the Messiah's time on earth. So, you know, and it's also being able to see it from that way. It's kind of like getting a map, a roadmap of what this is supposed to do for us. You know, and I want us to think beyond just the Christmas gift of Jesus. Not that that isn't really a super special gift. It is amazing to think that our God would come to humanity, take on our body, and just live the life that we live, and therefore kind of redeem every experience that we would have. That is amazing enough. But then consider this, that he's now going to outline kind of our history and the enemy's strategy in it to undermine us. And in so doing, he's going to give us the key to defeat Satan. Now, most of us think of Revelation as a prophetic book about future events that haven't yet occurred, and some of that's true, or otherwise a very confusing book with rich prophetic imagery that who can understand, and some of that is true also. Revelation is confusing because it doesn't follow a straight line. It presents human history in seven cycles, and it kind of adds more information and fleshes out more dimensions every time it cycles back. And this adds to the confusion because it's not kind of a strict timeline like we would like or the way we think. So it doesn't list things in quite a chronological order. And even when it does, there can be great periods of time between those events. But Revelation 12 pulls back the curtain so that we can see that our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but rather principalities. Revelation 12, 1-2 reads, "Now a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. Then being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth." Now this is the nativity from heaven's perspective, so the woman must be Mary, right? Well, it's not exactly Mary, it's rather more than that. It is Mary, of course, in one sense, it's just that it's much bigger. There's something larger going on here. The woman is a sign. In other words, signs point to something else. She's not a literal woman. But if she isn't a literal woman, then who is she? And we get a clue to this way back in Genesis, at the opposite end of the Bible, Genesis 37, 9-11. Joseph is dreaming. And then he dreamed still another dream, and he told it to his brothers and said, "Look, I have dreamed another dream. And this time, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars bowed down to me." So he told it to his father and his brothers. And his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you?" So it's clear that Jacob, that is Israel, interprets the dream to mean himself and his wife and sons. And additionally, in Isaiah 66, refers to Israel as a woman in labor. The woman represents Israel, longing to bring forth the promised seed, the seed that will crush the head of the serpent from Genesis 3:15. And of course, the seed is Jesus the Messiah. And church, now, as we have been adopted in, we have become the true Israel as well. So this is going to become like a prophecy seated in a prophecy, right? We are now the woman in her role as bride of Christ. As Israel labored to bring forth the Messiah, the church is now laboring to bring forth its seed, that is, the kingdom. And this dual meaning will become a little bit more obvious through my message, I hope. Revelation 12, 3 and 4 continues, "And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his head. His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth, to devour her child as soon as it was born." Well, who would this be? I mean, Herod was certainly a dragon, but rather, again, the symbolism is still deeper. In the Bible, the dragon is always the source of chaos and evil. He is fiery, again pointing back to the serpent in Genesis 3. Obviously, Satan. 10 horns. He's very powerful, very aggressive, very victorious. Actually, the horns represent royalty and authority in an earthly sense. The 7 diadems, much authority, maybe even total authority on earth. The power and authority of the dragon is described elsewhere in the next chapter of Revelation. Revelation 3:13-7 says that it was granted to him to make war against the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. All who dwell in the earth will worship him. So this is the power of this dragon. Verse 4, a third of the stars of heaven, Satan has destroyed a third of the angels with him. Satan is waiting to devour the seed of the woman. He's waiting to destroy the Messiah. He is the force behind Herod's scheme to kill the Messiah, even if he needs to kill every male toddler in the process. He'll do it. He is the tempter of Jesus. He is the offense behind the Pharisees and the reason for the religious opposition to Jesus' ministry. He motivates the crucifixion itself. Just as Satan came against Israel in the church age, so he will come against the church. And he has. The struggling against the church with offense and temptation, trying to stop and destroy the seed that we are laboring to deliver, the kingdom of heaven. In Revelation 12:5-6 continues, she bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up to God in his throne. Then the woman fled into the wilderness, where she had a place prepared by God that they should feed her there 1,260 days. The male child to rule all nations with a rod of iron. This is the Messiah, of course, Jesus, but to rule with a rod of iron is to be unbendable and of unbreakable might, to induce the submission of the world. Psalm 2:7-9 is a messianic prophecy that ensures that we're on the right track here. And it reads, I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, you are my son, today I have begotten you. Ask of me and I will give you the nations for your inheritance and the ends of the earth for your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. But verse 6 says, the child is taken up to God's throne. Even though the crucifixion has occurred, God has a plan in it. The child is resurrected and ascends to the throne of God and is seated at God's right hand. The dragon cannot kill the woman or her seed then or now or ever. He could not stop Israel from delivering the Messiah. He cannot destroy the church or the kingdom it sows. He cannot destroy you and I. The dragon hates the woman and her seed and relentlessly attacks them. The woman fled to the wilderness. Now again, in the beginning of this, I lay out that this seems like a nice chronological order, but this can be over vast periods of time. And I want to tell you an interpretation of this as it pertains to the nation of Israel. The woman is dispersed to the wilderness. That is, Israel flees Israel for the Gentile nations in the wilderness. And she's dispersed throughout the nations of the world where God has prepared a place for her, but then that they should feed her, that is, sustain her, utterly sustain her for 1,260 days. That 1,260 is actually a pretty accurate number from the date of the decree of the final solution in 1941 to VE Day in 1945. And I think that that's the kind of thing that Satan uses an attack against us. And if it came to Israel, it's surely the sort of thing coming our direction as well. But Satan's plan to eliminate the woman is thwarted again. Well, this seems to be a quick read and a quick chronology. There is a big time gap here, and it seems to be the case in other stories as well. For example, Daniel's 77's prophecy, you know, the Messiah is cut off from the land of the living on the 69th seven, and then there seems to be some gap until the final seven is fulfilled, and this gap indeed points to some future tribulation and a time when God needs to protect the church too, as Israel was protected. And I want to go beyond our morning reading and show you the gift now that I'm talking about. Revelation 12, 7 to 12 reads, "Then war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back, but he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray, was hurled to the earth, and his angels with him. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, 'Now have come the salvation and the power of the kingdom of our God. And for the accuser of our brothers and sisters who accuses them before our God day and night has been hurled down. They triumphed over him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death. Therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down to you, and he is full of fury, because he knows his time is short.'" Well, there's an awful lot to unpack here, but I believe, just in short sake here, I believe that we're now in this period of heavenly war, the spiritual war, as we've already become part of the kingdom of God. We are secure from Satan's ability to destroy us, but Satan's tactic is still offense. It's still to get you to become offended. You should be offended, and it's whispered in your ear as accusation. And this has been his tactic all along in the garden. Did God really say? Is God really good? It's been his tactic between Cain and Abel in the book of Job, and it will lead eventually to the rise of the Antichrist at some point, just as the offended population of Germany brought Hitler to power, so it will be with the Antichrist. As long as Satan has access in heaven, he accuses the brothers and sisters, that's us, the saints, to God both night and day. Satan still accuses. He accuses you and I, but those accusations are mitigated by Christ. Now he accuses God to you. God's not fair. He's not worthy of your praise. You know, wouldn't God really cure your illness, shield you from pain, provide for your desires? A good God would do that, Satan will whisper in your ear. And he accuses you to yourself. You know, you're not worthy. Every time Satan unrolls the scrolls, every time he proposes, you know, remember the time you got cut off in traffic and you were angry, and, you know, if they only knew in church the truth about you, you'd be bounced out of that place. Every time he lures with temptation that works the best to entice you, yet still, every time it is finished. Christ has died, and his death is sufficient. Satan battles over our bodies because he's lost the war for our souls. The saints conquer by the blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony. They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death. In other words, we are winning by trusting Christ's covenant, by the testimony of what Christ has done for us. The more Satan accuses, the more Satan wreaks havoc, the greater our testimony. The greater our testimony, the closer his defeat. The more evil and destruction, you know, in the new covenant, we need to believe Christ has already set in motion this plan for victory. And this plan will, without a doubt, succeed. You see, the seed is the very thing that destroys Satan. God coming to earth in human form to absorb all the evil that Satan could muster. Then, now, and forever, it is finished. We win by trusting Christ with our lives. In this way, we defeat Satan in this heavenly war. Who is it that dwells in the heavens, by the way? It is us. We are the ones whose names are written in the book of life, who have been washed clean by the blood of the Lamb. The message today, here in the power of Christ, I stand. No scheme of hell can pluck us from his hand. And that is a wonderful gift. Amen.